what you're trying to say is that is that in a cultural analogy, it's not random, it's more directed. So you have a goal in mind, which is to make soup or make a better soup, and so you try different ways, which is not the model of randomness in biological mutation, where there's no goal in mind and there's no designer. It's just random mutations happening by accident.
I was thinking that there might be a bit of randomness. Say, for example, someone comes from one culture and learns another culture's soup. The kind of way that they frame or understand it will be random, because it'll just be totally contingent upon what culture you come from. So say, say you come from a culture where all the onions you use are red onions, and then you take back a soup, like a French onion soup, and you start making it with red onions or something like that. So it could be random in that way.
Right. Yeah, good point.
But so, I think the point is taken, though, that because the experimentation, it could be completely random. A person could just go to the supermarket and try things out, but that's not how people actually experiment with these things. They seem to have a kind of directness to it.
Yeah, but your point is well taken. But I just wanted to say that you are listening, listener, you are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. In case you're wondering what we're talking about biological evolution, cultural evolution, the relationship between the two. I am Michael Robert Kaditz. I'm here with my co-host, Brandon Brownlee, and we will continue. So, Brandon, I'm glad you brought up this possible analogy between the way the culture develops and the way biological change happens, or biological evolution happens, because I think that leads, in my mind, to another problem, actually. So it's complicated, because let's speak from the point of view of physical human beings. So from the point of view of physical human beings, the development of culture is not analogous to the development of genetics, because of what I said before, because genetic information is transmitted such that it's innately received, it's inherited by future generations, no need to relearn it. But from the point of view of humans, unless the cultural information, unless the beliefs or values were transmitted genetically, which is possible, and maybe some are, but to the extent that they're not, that cultural beliefs, cultural information is not transmitted genetically, it is learned through sense perception, which is quite distinct from inheritance. So they're quite different from the point of view of physical human beings. A newborn physical human being has inherited genetic traits, but must learn through sense perception cultural values, according to this model. Unless you were to argue that newborn humans inherit beliefs, which is possible also, or maybe there's a combination. But if the analogy you're trying to make is that cultural transmission through sense perception is analogous to biological transmission through genetics, it's not, because the former is innate and the latter is learned. But it gets more nuanced than that, because now let's talk about it from the point of culture, not from a physical human, but from the point of culture, if culture could have a point of view. I think this is what you were getting at, Brandon. If you're culture, then you can say that there's been an evolution of knowledge, a body of knowledge that has accumulated over time. And that seems, in a way, quite obvious, because think about, for example, that primitive humans, early humans, didn't have the capacity to use tools, to make tools the way that humans later developed. So there's been this like evolution of knowledge around, harnessing fire, making wheels, and now our technology has increased. increased in complexity and in capacity to accomplish tasks with less effort. I'm not saying that that's a good thing because a lot of damage has been done in the process. So I'm not getting into that sideshow here. But it seems obvious that in many departments, right, in many ways, there's been an accumulation, a sort of a progression of cultural knowledge. It may be lost at times and then reacquired. Certain civilizations have had a lot of knowledge that disappeared. But in general, you could make a reasonable argument that culture, from its point of view, has evolved without having to relearn from square one, you know, for every new generation. So new generations of human don't have to reinvent the wheel. So it's sort of an interesting paradox, which is that from a physical point of view, culture is not analogous to biology, but from a cultural point of view, it may be quite analogous, which leads me to get even more confused, because how can culture have a point of view? How can culture be anything that's not physical that has a different perspective than the physical? So how can I say on one hand, well, from a physical perspective, culture is different, but from a cultural perspective, it's the same? That just seems really weird. And it seems very dualist, because now I'm like speaking of culture as though it's like a distinct substance from the physical, which has its own point of view and its own way of looking at its own history. But that doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah, and that's why I thought it was helpful to bring an example and to use something like a soup, right? It ended up being a French onion soup that got mutated to use red onions, because where this person learned to make soups, they used white onions, but they came back home where they only use red onions. And so there is a kind of physical change in the evolution of French onion soup. You know, looking at it from the perspective of French onion soup, French onion soup went to this place where they only use red onions, and then it adapted to thrive in this new cultural environment, and now everyone loves red French onion soup.
Yeah, but French onion soup can't have a perspective. It's not a, it's just matter. It's not a substance. You know, it's just matter. It can't have a viewpoint. So I understand why, you know, we might want to go there and say, well, you know, from culture's point of view, it's evolved. If I were culture, I would say I have evolved. Right? With every new generation, I don't have to relearn stuff. You know, my offspring don't have to relearn how to make a wheel. It's already been invented, and that information has been retained and transmitted from generation to generation. But the problem with that is I'm not an entity. I'm not a thing. You know, what is culture? Culture isn't like a thing that a living thing that has a perspective. I mean, you might say, oh, it is a living thing. Okay, well, go ahead and take that position, right? But that's dualism. You know, now you have like an immaterial substance with its own like perspective on things. Anyway, that's the problem I see. Anyway, I want to move on. Oh, by the way, before I do though, Brandon, I want to just underscore what you said. Like, clearly you could say that, that cultural change might result from random events. Like, you might be making the onion soup and inadvertently, like randomly, just like drop a stick into the soup and then say, oh wow, the soup's better because the stick's in there. That it might become part of the recipe in the future, but it was randomly, like you randomly accidentally dropped a stick in the soup. So that would make it more, yeah,
not unheard of in the history of cuisine, people right. happening upon really interesting dishes. Yeah,
right. But does that make culture a distinct or semi-distinct entity from biology? That's what I'm questioning. So I want to start thinking about culture in biological terms. I don't know if I can reduce it to it, but I want to start going in that direction because I want to try and clear up some of these ambiguities that I think are inherent in an attempt to hold culture out as a semi-distinct or a distinct entity. And I think Heinrich, from what I understand, runs into some of these problems, which are difficult to overcome when you try and treat culture as an entity beyond and more than or distinct from or semi-distinct from human biology. So how can we start to think of culture if I want to, which I do, as a more biological thing to try and eliminate some of this like dualism that's infiltrating this dual inheritance model, hence the word dual, right? I don't like it. So I was speaking to someone and he said to me, I have a definition of culture. And I said, oh, what is it? I really want to hear it. And the definition was that he suggested was not his invention, right? But he pointed it out. He said, well, culture is like the middle layer of a system with an input and an output, which sounded to me like a neural network or a connectionist network. In a very simple model of a connectionist network, I think neural and connectionist are sort of interchangeable terms. You have inputs, but then you have a hidden middle layer which maps the inputs to the outputs in order to produce the outputs that you want, or the outputs that are successful or that work, right? And so you tune this neural network such that the middle layer is able to map and put weightings on the various channels and so on. I'm not a real expert on this. I hope I'm saying it correctly. But I think the important point is that it's a self-tuning network designed to produce the correct output. Am I getting that right, Brandon, from what you know?
Yeah, that sounds about right to me. It has to do with handling inputs and outputs in a way that achieves a kind of balance.
That's really what culture is. Culture is that middle layer in a physical connectionist network, which is tuned to provide the correct output. So let's think about an example of that. I thought of immediately, well, social contract theory. The input is the state of nature, right? Hobbesian state of nature. The war of all against all. No rational person would want to live in such a state of self-interested people fighting with each other constantly. That's the input into the system. So the output, I'll get to the middle layer next, but the output is going to be, the desired output is going to be a more rational, livable, civilized community, country, nation, whatever, place to live. That's the desired output.
As opposed to the state of nature, the state of civility.
So a civil state is the desired output. What's the middle layer? The middle layer in this example would be the social contract. So social contract theorists advocate the construction of a social contract whose input is chaos and whose output is order and civilization and a livable society. So the social contract, it's not controversial that that is at least one aspect of culture. So part of the culture we live in consists of the political state, the laws, enforcement of the laws, right? Crime and punishment. There's a lot of resources put into this middle layer of this connectionist system, which inputs chaos, which has no, according to Hobbesian view, there's no morality, there's no rules, just chaotic war of all against all. That's the input. Middle layer, the political state with enforcement of rules. Output, a much better place to live. And that middle layer is culture. And there's other examples too you can use. You can say that, for example, if you view the world or society as being largely a coercive type model where those with more power and more resources have an interest in coercing the masses to obey the rules such as to maintain the status quo, to protect the wealth and resources and power of the rich people. I mean, that's one way of looking at society. You might not view it that way, but certainly some do. Some do. If that was your way, you could also apply the neural network model and say that that middle layer, the cultural layer, is comprised of laws, rules, values, which are taught to people through sense perception in order to produce the desired output. So I started to wonder whether this might be one way to approach a definition of culture, which is more of a physical, biological explanation than this mysterious thing about, you know, whatever like this duality is. So could it be that humans, in all the complexities of their sophisticated brains, house within their brains, within their physical brains, the capacity to join together with other physical brains and to create this big neural network, which receives input from the surrounding world, produces output. And when we talk about culture, we're using a metaphor or a euphemism or a sort of a descriptive language to speak to what is a physical connectionist network operating in physical brains. What about that?
Yeah, that would make sense to me. I mean, you think about, I mean, if this middle layer is something kind of self-regulating, if it's something kind of self-regulating, then I think you have the situation for that just in human plurality. I mean, I think about the Hobbesian state of nature. The state of nature happens because there's, I mean, one of the conditions for the state of nature is having more than one person, right? Everyone is looking out for themselves, but if there was only one person, they wouldn't have to look out for themselves against anyone else. In a culture, I mean, maybe you could have a culture in one person, but the culture that we're talking about has more than one person to it, and you want to regulate your behavior in relation to other humans. So if you can find the neurology of how people regulate their behavior in accord with the behavior of others, you know, the perception of social situations, customs, and the way that people are expected to conduct themselves in particular, if you can find brain states for that, you have grounds for something like a middle layer of an input, which is, I have kind of in the background already the Freudian meta psychology of id, ego, and superego. So you have this pure id, people just want things, but the output is ultimately going to be an ego or a self, which is mediated by some, and we can replace superego here with something like a more ethical neurology or something like that, or the way that culture operates in the brain. The output is you get to be a person. You get to exist in this culture, as opposed to being someone who just totally satisfies all desires, all cravings. I'm thinking you just go pure id.
I can even refine this model further than I just did, because I just said that the desired output is like a more civilized, better place to live, but that's not correct, because now I'm invoking psychology again. So really what I should be saying is that the desired output is whatever state leads to evolutionary advantage. Maybe it's the case that society, which looks like the type of society we live in, produces an evolutionary advantage, not necessarily in a value judgment sense, but advantage like in a mechanistic sense. Because, for example, increase in food production through modern agricultural techniques would provide an evolutionary advantage. So maybe all that's really going on here, notwithstanding all this like cultural talk and dual inheritance talk, what's really going on here is that human brains are like a neural network of multiple computers, right? You could build a network of computers which would all be part of a neural network, taking input, producing desired output, and the engineers, the software engineers, would fine-tune the middle layer to learn what the correct configuration was to produce the right output, the desired output. So maybe that from a biological sense, we're not going to go into this weird place of talking from culture's point of view, which I deny exists, right? From a biological point of view, we have biological brains operating together in the same way that, you know, computers would operate together to tune themselves to produce an output which is more fit for replication, you know, continuous replication of the species. Maybe we're overthinking this whole thing about culture. Maybe many, many people and theorists have been overthinking it. Maybe we're, what we're really looking at is simply a physical mechanism which consists of many human brains, which is fine-tuning itself in a natural selection sense, right? So the way that these neural networks are fine-tuned is a natural adaptation because the output they produce produces the most fitness. Maybe that's all there really is here, and there's no dual inheritance or anything like that. What about that?
It's interesting you say, like, well, from the point of view of culture, that would be, you know, what would that look like? But in this kind of model, it seems like humans are kind of the cells of a cultural organism in a way. And what the culture might view as good or bad for itself is more or less a response to its environment that it lives in. Because I think you arrive at something like a cultural organism through this, because it's going through certain adaptations to self. You're producing a self-regulating system of cultural norms through the mediating plurality of human minds. Am I right?
Yeah, that's a good point. And what's interesting about this theory is that in some way we can match this up to one way of viewing the relationship in a single mind, a single human, between mind and body. And it's by no means the only way of looking at this relationship under the umbrella of materialist theories of mind, but it's one that I really like because it's pretty clear. And it would be a theory called anomalous monism. It was promoted by Donald Davidson. What it suggests is that descriptions using language, psychological language, description of things going on in my mind, like I'm feeling sad or I'm scared, or psychological descriptions are merely alternate language for physical events. So there's an event happening in my brain, or there's a condition or a state in my brain, a biological state in my brain, which I'm describing as I'm afraid or I have a pain. But the description is anomalous, right? So the concept, the conscious concept that I have doesn't cause anything. It doesn't do anything. It's just, in a way, it's epiphenomenal, although Davidson would disagree that his theory is one of epiphenomenalism. That's another debate. But what's underlying physical, psychological descriptions are always biological events in the brain. And for those that want to know the nuance of this, they would be type, but rather token events. So every conscious description is a description of a token brain event. That seems to match up pretty well with what I'm postulating around cultural events. So talk of cultural values, cultural ideas is descriptive language for what are really biological states or events in a physical neural network. So the neural network is tuned to produce advantageous outputs. And just like a computer system would be tuned, the software or even the hardware, the various characteristics of the physical computer system, a bunch of computers in a computer room, right, in a building, all physical. Same thing with multiple human minds, all physical. And when you talk about, well, our culture has evolved from, you know, using sticks to make fire to now, you know, using lighter fluid or whatever, you're describing the, you know, increase in the fine tuning of the physical neural network of the computers that our brains are.
Yeah. And it seems to just the, on first blush, it seems you really have made a kind of genuine metaphysical philosophical departure from the dual inheritance theory when you do this. And so you possibly avoid its problems, because if dual inheritance theory implies a kind of paralleled model, or however their relationship is in this model that you're positing, culture seems to emerge from and is dependent upon biological means, neurological means. So that is a radical departure from the dual inheritance theory, it seems.
Okay, thank you very much, Brandon Brownlee. My name is Michael Robert Kaditz. You have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from